TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Global warming, a quarter century of unheeded warnings. 350 parts per million has become one of the most often quoted numbers, thanks to environmentalist Bill McKibben. It is the presence of CO2 in our atmosphere. The old normal at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution was 290 parts per million. The current frighteningly high number is already 390 parts per million. And respected and concerned scientists such as James Hansen and Stephen Schneider say, we need to return to 350 as soon as possible to avoid climate collapse. But there's no indication that that is happening. Fossil fuel extraction and burning raises CO2 output across the world year by year. And there's a mad dash to open up more fuel sources through fracking, deep sea and Arctic drilling. In his global internet broadcast, TED Talk, in February 2012, Hansen said that the last time CO2 was at 390 parts per million, sea level rose to 50 feet above current normal. That rise will not all come at once, but most estimates say that we will get at least 3 feet by the end of this century, maybe even 18. The window of opportunity to halt sea level rise is closing. In the same TED Talk, Hansen said that if we had started reducing emissions in 2005, it would have taken only a 3% reduction per year to restore energy balance and stabilize the climate. If we begin now in 2013, a 6% reduction is necessary. And if we wait another 10 years, the reduction has to be 15% per year. And we have not even started yet. Scientists who issue climate warnings are being targeted by highly financed lobbies and think tanks of supporters of the oil and coal industry. James Hansen himself, for a while in 2005, was under White House-induced orders not to speak in public unless NASA had given permission. Few climate scientists have been as seriously targeted as Hansen and Stephen Schneider. Both already had high standing in their fields as they went public. Hansen as head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City, and Schneider as professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Stanford University and former department director at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. None of these efforts succeeded in getting Hansen or Schneider fired. Their science was unassailable. James Hansen has become more outspoken and active than ever, literally fighting for the future of his grandchildren. Schneider's voice fell silent when he died in the summer of 2010 on a flight home from a climate conference in Sweden. In spite of health problems, he continued to travel and talk, driven by the urgency of the climate problem he knew so well. The last photo his widow found on his camera is a tall white windmill in a meadow in Sweden. Schneider's name came up recently when the Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communications was given to James Hansen. The ceremony by Climate One at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco united the two men who had been colleagues and later friends for decades. Hansen remembered Schneider's courage when both were at the NASA Goddard Institute as young men.
Steve Schneider was a friend from way decades ago. In his first year as a postdoc, he was already at that time trying to reach the public, and he wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times. At that time, the director of the Goddard Institute did not appreciate that sort of thing. And he called a meeting of entire people in the building, more than 100 people, and he really gave it to Steve. And the really impressive thing about Steve was, you know, he didn't back down. Even at that time, and he's just this 26 or 27-year-old postdoc, he had the courage to stand up for what he believed in. For all those things about Steve, it is a great honor to get an award in his name. Thanks.
On TUC Radio's last program, you heard Hansen's December 2012 acceptance speech. This, by extension, is my credit to Schneider, whose name on the press coverage of the award came up only as, quote, a Stanford professor who died. Nothing about his very unique and holistic view, based on his expertise in biology and atmospheric science, his ability to describe how climate and life evolved together, and how that process is falling apart as humans are disturbing the Earth. I interviewed Steven Schneider 3 times and consider each recording a treasure. Here today is my first meeting with Schneider in his office at Stanford in 1998. I was curious and grateful to meet the only scientist I could find at that time who was willing to talk on the record on climate change. I was setting up my equipment as Schneider arrived on his bicycle. How would you like to be introduced?
Well, I could be introduced as a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences, as well as a senior fellow in the Institute for International Studies and a professor by courtesy in civil engineering. And the reason for all this is not pretension, but to prove that institutions of higher learning, even excellent ones like Stanford, still don't have departments of problems where we actually solve real-world issues. We still have disciplines like biology and policy studies or engineering. And what I work at is the interface of all of them, because that's what describes the climate problem. People ask me, what's the big deal about climate change? A few degrees? Heck, one side of a mountain is a few degrees warmer or colder than the other side. One day is 15 degrees warmer or colder than the next. So why are we worried about a few degrees? And I'll remind them that if you actually drive up the mountain, you can see how the vegetation changes quite significantly as you keep going a couple of hundred feet higher, Well, that's because over the long term, these small degrees of temperature matter. So exposure to large changes in a short period of time are one thing, but being exposed to large changes over a longer period of time are another. And the rate at which those changes occur are very important.
You gave the example of glaciers and ice ages where a cooling and then a warming trend happened over a significantly longer period of time.
If you think about climate as a global event, we're not thinking just what happens in the North Atlantic region in Europe, but the whole world on an average, and you say, what are the big sweeps of Earth history? Well, in the last 500,000 years, the big sweeps, the large changes, the massive things you'd see if you were a space traveler and looking at the Earth just with your eyes, is the ice ages and the so-called interglacials or warm periods. We're now in an interglacial or warm period. An ice age, where ice sheets literally came down across Northern Europe, across North America, through most of Canada, right on down. The last ice age was called the Wisconsin. Guess why? The ice got to Wisconsin, and I grew up on Long Island, and the South Shore of Long Island is a wash, sandy beach, and the North Shore is rolling hills, because the North Shore is how far the glacier got, and it sort of left its rubble in those rolling hills. So the ice age was quite spectacular and quite cold relative to what we know, but most people are shocked to hear the ice age was only about 5 to 7 degrees Celsius colder than an interglacial. In other words, about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly, colder than now. And that's because on a sustained global average basis, 10 Fahrenheit's a whopping big number. Forests moved thousands of kilometers. Species went extinct. It was literally revamping the ecological face of the planet, that 10 degree Fahrenheit, 5 degree Celsius change. Now, how fast did it happen? On a sustained global basis, we know the ice age was at its maximum about 20,000 years ago, and we know that by about 10,000 years ago, it was essentially over, and we've had a very stable period of climate for the last 10,000 years in which human civilization evolved, and that period has a fancy name called the Holocene, and we evolved, the habitats we know are here, and the climate never varied more than a degree or two from its current value. Yet the transition from the Ice Age to the interglacial took place in less than 10,000 years, maybe five. But when you think about it, 5 degrees Celsius happening in 5,000 years is a globally average sustained rate of about 1 degree per 1,000 years. That's relatively rapid for nature. We're talking for human impacts on climate in the next century of being lucky to hold it to 1 degree Celsius in the next century. And we could, if we're unlucky and or foolish, see it as high as 4 or 5 degrees in the next century. So we could see temperature differences almost the magnitude of an ice age interglacial cycle, this time being induced by humans, but not taking place in thousands of years, taking place in a century. And that very rapid rate, virtually all ecologists and others who look at nature say natural systems can't adapt, and human systems would have a great deal of difficulty adapting to change at that rate. That's the problem that most people feel about the risk of climate change if business as usual continues. So what we've done is we've painted ourselves into the corner where the kinds of climate change that could occur through our own activities could be much more devastating than they would be if our world were more resilient. So in a way, the very objects that we use to improve our quality of life, the use of energy and materials and the clearing of land and so forth, ironically feed back and degrade nature in a way that threatens our quality of life. And what many of us keep saying is, can't we slow down the rate at which we impact the system? Do we have to have so many people getting rich so fast that we neglect the consequences of that behavior?
Now, this question is sort of basic, but the answer to it is still so concealed because it points to certain industries. What are the main greenhouse gases?
Well, the primary greenhouse gas in the natural world, let me distinguish for a minute the natural greenhouse gas from the augmented one. The natural greenhouse effect is the sum of water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, ozone, and a few other small trace gases that allow about half the sun's energy through to the Earth's surface, but then block and trap and re-radiate back down to the surface 80 to 90% of the energy that otherwise would have escaped to space. This is not controversial. There is no scientific doubt. The greenhouse effect as a natural proposition is as solid a theory as there is in atmospheric science. Virtually nobody disputes it, the natural greenhouse effect. The debate comes along on the fact that this increasing number of humans wanting to get rich as fast as possible and use cheap technology, when we do these things, we build up one greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide. Now, it's not the principal greenhouse gas. Water vapor is. But the reason carbon dioxide is so important is it's the one we're changing. And what we do is we trap extra heat. Currently, we've added about 2 watts of energy over every square meter of the Earth. And that extra heat is added to the system. So the real question then is, how do you distribute that heat? If it just warms up the surface, we should have warmed up, a degree or two already. Well, we haven't warmed up that much. We've only warmed up about a half degree Celsius. So something else is happening.
In 100 years.
In 100 years, right. So we're only going about half of what we probably should have. That sounds like good news, but it turns out that when we burn fossil fuels, particularly coal and oil with sulfur in it, we don't just put the heat-trapping carbon dioxide out there, but we also put out sulfur dioxide. And that's one of these eye-irritating, lung-damaging smogs, and they're very much related to health effects. Remember the London smogs that led to people to stop burning coal in London because they were literally killing people? And it's happening again in Beijing while the Chinese repeat the mistakes of the Victorian Industrial Revolution. Well, it turns out that those hazes, those industrial hazes and acid smogs, they also reflect energy back to space, so they cool. So humans are out there pushing the world toward warming through these greenhouse gases all around the planet and then pulling it back toward cooling in these pockets or regions where we have heavy industrial or transportation use of energy. So we're pushing and we're pulling and we're doing it in funny ways. And it's that combination that probably has kept us at about a half degree warming rather than one. The real problem is, as the Chinese and the Indians and others start to repeat that industrialization that we did, again using cheap and dirty fuels, they'll start pulling the sulfur out of those fuels simply because they don't want to choke to death. In the process, that means that we'll end up getting the full warming, not the warming, some of which is offset by these acid pollutants. So we're going to face the 21st century with the good news that they'll probably start to control pollution that directly affects health and ecosystems. The bad news is once you do that, you lose some of the offset to the global warming. We'll end up with a lot more of it than we otherwise would have had, unless we have the real good news, which is to transition away from fossil fuels and toward more renewable, safe, if you will, environmentally safe, alternative technologies.
So what do you think is the next step?
Charging people for dumping their junk in the atmosphere. The economists have a name for it. They call it carbon tax. And, oh, my God, the word tax. How is that politically acceptable? Another tax. But you think about it. If we don't charge people for dumping their junk in the atmosphere, it's not free. It just costs somebody whose climate is degraded or somebody who lives in a coastline when the sea level rises or there's a more intense storm. It costs all of us in terms of reducing the number of species in the world when they get pushed around by climate change, but now they can't migrate because they've got factories, farms, freeways, and urban settlements to cross. So there are real costs, the economists call this climate damage, from business as usual. But right now, there's no incentive for people not to continue business as usual because the atmosphere is free. Well, why is it that my smokestack or your tailpipe should be free? Where does this free market logic that I keep hearing from political conservatives that it's a violation of our entrepreneurial rights to tax energy? Well, it's a violation of the market to have real damages done and not put the costs into the price of energy. So we have vastly underpriced energy. Energy right now, look at a gallon of gasoline. What does it cost typically? Can you imagine the sanity of this world when the price of water is 3 times more than the price of an exhaustible resource like energy that we will need for the next couple of hundred years? It's outrageous, and no wonder we're building up so much junk in the atmosphere because we've created an artificially set of low prices, particularly in the United States and in places like China and other areas where we subsidize this stuff in the name of protecting certain industries, but we claim it's the free market. It's not a free market. It's a rigged market. It's rigged to the status quo and to protect strong interests. As a result of that, the free sewer is building up and building up and building up, and now we're facing the prospect of substantial climate change because we don't provide adequate incentives for people to develop alternatives because the price is too low. Now, immediately people will say, wait a minute, you want to raise the price of energy? That's unfair because poor countries like China or poor people like urban dwellers in inner cities in the U.S., they will pay a disproportionately larger share of their disposable income on the extra energy price than will rich people. Indeed, it's true, but they're also polluting. And my view is that you have to separate out the effectiveness of environmental action, for which getting the prices right is key, from the ethics of the equity problem, which is very important. You deal with equity through giving people the opportunity for what they need, which is resources and knowledge. You don't subsidize poverty through artificially low prices of energy. You do it through direct transfer of resources. So if you were to increase the price of energy by an amount that would increase everybody's budget by X percent, but then you rebated that money to them by lowering the tax brackets, particularly for the poorest people or the poorest countries, then you'd be able to deal with both the effectiveness of the environmental policy and at the same time with the equity problem by returning to people what they need, which is resources, but at the same time penalizing wasteful consumption. We have increased carbon dioxide to a level now that's about 20% higher than it's been in the measurements that we have over the last 500,000 years, probably higher than it's been in several million years, that the rate of change at which we're increasing it is faster than it's been in modern geologic time, that we're doing that at the same time that we're fragmenting habitat through chopping down forests and forcing wild species into smaller and smaller and smaller patches. It's a no-brainer to see that there's going to be an extinction crisis wiping out lots and lots and lots of species. The problem is, does anybody care? Does anybody value them? I think the answer is yes, many people do. But when valuing those species conflicts with the immediate jobs of small segments of society who know that the remedies are going to hurt them, they're organized. The beneficiaries, which are the vast bulk of humanity diffused throughout the world, people of the next generation, they either aren't here to vote or they're not organized, they're busy with other things. So even though you can show, and I think you can show very well, that solving the problem of environmental degradation and climate change can actually be a net benefit to humanity over the time frame of a century. The winners are diffused through society and in the future. The losers are organized and concentrated. They know it. They're advertising. They're paying lobbyists. They're buying off politicians. They're sending out distorted advertisements. And they're dominating the discussion. And the media is dutifully covering all of it as if it's a matter of balance. And therefore, it doesn't frighten everybody that carbon dioxide is increasing at an unprecedented rate, because they're hearing all this spin about how that's good for you.
We have certainly seen a quite dramatic series of extreme weather events. What do you make of those?
If the world gets heated by adding greenhouse gases, as we're doing, and that's certain, we're going to evaporate more water, and that's virtually certain. Now, what goes up has to come down. So that means when the atmosphere is configured to rain, when you get the right convergence of jet stream and moisture flows and so forth, there's going to be more intense rain. It's virtually required, because if you put more stuff in, more stuff has to come out. On the other hand, what happens when the atmosphere is configured toward being clear and sunny and warm and dry? Well, if it's a little bit warmer, that's going to suck more moisture out of the ground. So theoretically, we've reached a forecast without even having to crank up the computer that we should expect on average around the world an increase in the likelihood of extreme floods and droughts because of the intensification of the hydrological cycle. Now, nature is very noisy. It's what we call background variability. So it's very hard to tell whether the wild extremes of the recent past are just nature rolling double snake eyes, or whether we've now loaded the dice and it's us that's starting to be responsible. And of course, those people who want to deny will then grab that caution and say, you see, there's nothing definitive out there. We don't know anything. And it's not true. We know that the case is actually very strong. In the U.S., for example, we have about a 8 to 10% increase in average rainfall over the last century. That may just be natural accident, although it's completely consistent with what our computer models tell us should happen from the extra greenhouse gases. So while that's not proof, it's another piece of circumstantial evidence. But that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing that Tom Carl and his colleagues in the U.S. Climate Center have found is that the bulk of the increase in rainfall took place in the top 10% of intense events. In other words, the gully washers, the heavy rainfall events. Well, those are the flooders, and those are the ones that cause catastrophic outcomes. The Hurricane Mitch is an example of that. It was an increase in the heavy rainfall category, precisely the kind of things that has the reinsurance industry in a panic. Mariah, you said earlier that there were expensive industries that were out trying to protect their interests, and indeed there are. Fossil fuel industry is a trillion-dollar industry. But so is the insurance industry a trillion-dollar industry. And then now standing up face-to-face with the fossil fuel industry saying, wait a minute, doing nothing may be good for you guys, but doing nothing may put us out of business. So there's a lot of concern from other groups, not just the fossil fuel industry, that maybe we really do have to deal with the commons, and it really does cost money. My most recent book, I deliberately picked the title Laboratory Earth, because I wanted people to understand the metaphor that science does not talk in certainties, it talks in probabilities. And this time, we're not talking about a cute scientific experiment in the ivy-covered halls of a college or in some glass-and-stone government lab. We're talking about an experiment with insects and trees and us along for the ride. And that gets back to human values. Do we want to take that chance of performing a planetary scale experiment where the bulk of the knowledgeable community tells us it's at least even betting odds that we're going to have nasty outcomes and 10% chance of potentially catastrophic outcomes and maybe a 10% chance that it'll be good for us in that, and just take the risk? We're talking about irreversible changes to the life support system of the Earth. And those risks, to me, even though they're not certain, justify action. Problem is, it's very difficult to get people to act on something they don't see. If you're not conscious about what's around you, you can't fix it. Because if you can't see it, you can't fix it. And the problem that we have from this cacophonous media debate, the political distortions, the fax machines that send out all this spin to everybody, emphasizing the worst or the best cases, is it leads to public confusion. People are trained in elementary school at the beginning of their lives that the truth comes from the front of the room, the professor knows, the teacher knows, and what do I know? And all of a sudden, you know, all these scientists fighting, they don't know, how do I know? But what they're missing is that this is not an issue that's knowable on the time frame that we need the answer. We're not going to know with 99.9% scientific certainty about these questions before 20 to 40 years from now. By that time, the atmosphere and the oceans will perform the experiment. We and the rest of nature has to suffer the risk. So every human being out there is just as qualified as every scientist to decide whether to take that risk and how much current resources they want to invest to try to slow it down. But if you're scared off the problem because it seems too complex and you've lost your self-esteem in school somewhere to somebody who told you they had the truth, you're missing what the role of the citizen is. And the role of the citizen is to decide how to take risks. You don't have to know every detail. All you have to know from us in science is what can happen and what are the odds. What to do is a value choice. And if you don't become conscious of that role, it'll be very difficult for democracy to work. We'll be simply stuck with politicians and special interests, not governed by the people. The people had better take their responsibility seriously. And that means to put a little bit of time into figure out what can happen. And that's not going to be found on the 2-minute sound bites on the evening news. They've got to look deeper.
That was the late Dr. Stephen Schneider, recorded in his office at Stanford in 1998. He was professor in the Biological Sciences Department and former department director at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. Schneider was also coordinating lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fourth Assessment Report in 2007. Schneider's research included modeling of the atmosphere and the relationship of biological systems to global climate change. Schneider is the author of Science as a Contact Sport, Inside the Battle to Save the Earth's Climate, Global Warming, Are We Entering the Greenhouse Century? And with Randy Lunder, The Co-Evolution of Climate and Life, and his very last book in 2010, with Michael Mastrandrea, Preparing for Climate Change. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD with Stephen Schneider and James Hansen by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and passing out. The precious moments to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.